Back in 1964, in some places in America, registering black voters was a capital crime. In Mississippi, among those executed in that year were two white New Yorkers, Mickey Schwirmer and Andrew Goodman, along with a black man, James Cheney.
I personally suspect that if Mr. Cheney, who is a native Mississippian Negro, had been alone at the time of the disappearance, that this case, like so many others who have that have come before, would have gone completely unnoticed.
That voices of Rita Schwirmer from the PBS documentary Freedom Summer, the bodies of her husband, Mickey, and the two other activists from the Freedom Summer 50 years ago were found weeks after their murders. In Mississippi, violence against outsiders coming to hasten the civil rights movement was tolerated. Only a few of the men responsible for their murder were convicted, and none of them served more than 6 years in prison. In the 1990s, these cases began to be reopened by prosecutors all around the country. Indictments and belated convictions were finally obtained. These trials were a search for justice, but in some communities, it was much more complicated. Renee Romano, a professor of history at Oberlin College, looked at these cases for her book, Racial Reckoning. She says prosecuting crimes of the past has been an important element of achieving racial justice, but she learned these trials cannot absolve communities of all of their sins.
One of the things these trials allow is for us to both explore the past and then we learn about the present by looking at the reopenings. And what we learn about the past, I think, is that violence was really a widespread tool of racial terror. And what we see is that although most of the crimes themselves were committed by a small group of men, often members of groups like the Ku Klux Klan, they were able to continue in their terror campaign because they had the tacit and sometimes open support of politicians, of the police, of law enforcement, and juries that acquitted them if they even went to trial. Many of these cases were never even charged. There were no charges brought. If they went to trial, they were most likely to end in mistrials, hung juries, or in acquittals.
Do you think that some communities in these re-prosecution of cases or even first-time prosecutions of cases are looking for an exoneration, that they are looking for the verdict in these cases to say this could never happen again here now? We're beyond any sense of racism. It's kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval for communities that still do have some reckoning.
Absolutely. I think there's been one impulse for these trials has been to essentially ask for a very easy reckoning. And that's been one of the framings of the trials in the media as well, and by some of the politicians who've come to support them, that by putting this man in jail, we can claim that we have moved on, that we have changed completely, that we have transcended our racist history and our racist past. And also we can really make the argument that what happened in the past doesn't have any more legacies for today. And this is really clear, for example, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where there is takes decades to get the Freedom Summer murders reopened, the killings of Mickey Schwirmer, Andrew Goodman, and James Cheney, a triple killing that happens in 1964. And Philadelphia had really held out. Other communities were reopening cases, and they had not moved forward. And eventually you get a community group together there that some of the people involved in that community group came forward and said, we need to try this because it's good for business, if nothing else. Right? We need to reopen this case because the reputation that we have as a racist place has hurt real estate development, made it hard to attract businesses. So we should do this, if nothing else, as an economic development case. And they really wanted to say, by putting one old man in jail, we have now shown that we are free from this history. And the newspaper editor there who most pushed this vision of an economic development argument when Edgar Ray Killen was convicted wrote an editorial where he paraphrased Martin Luther King and said, we are free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we're free at last.
Do you think Absolutely. This is a distortion of the civil rights evolution in America, or is this our form of reconciliation? We don't do it the same way they do it in South Africa and other places like Rwanda. We do it our way, and this is just, you know, where we are at this point on the continuum.
I think it's a distortion, honestly, because what we see happening is the crimes tell a story of systemic racism. They tell a story of broader state and community complicity in racial violence. They tell a story about how widespread and powerful violence was, and also about that depth of history that is going to continue to resonate today. What we get in many of the trials and in representations of them is instead a story of a few bad men who were acting outside of community community norms, who people didn't agree with then and don't agree with now, and who by putting in jail, we can say that we have overcome. It is very much not a truth and reconciliation process. A truth and reconciliation process would look broadly at what was, how do we understand the harms done in the past? How do we understand a broader responsibility for those harms? And how do we understand the legacies of those harms for today? And that's not what the trial process is doing.
As you have looked at this history and as I read about it, there's a curious reversal here that's almost chilling when you think about the latent tensions in places like St. Louis and Ferguson, where these police shootings produce so much of a reaction. Back in, you know, Natchez, Mississippi, and in other places during the civil rights era, the crime was clear. Everybody knew that it happened. There really was no dispute about the objective facts of the crime. It was whether anyone would react that was in dispute, whether anyone would take to the streets that was sort of unknown and ambiguous. Now it's reversed. The expectation is that people will take to the street. It's the circumstances of these police shootings, whether the cop was armed, whether the assailant was armed. That's all in dispute. It's a remarkable, like, 180 reversal.
It's very interesting. At the time, though, in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, when these crimes occurred, there was some of that kind of questioning. Was this really a crime? There was a lot of blaming of the victims. So when Emmett Till was killed. In his case, that murder case was reopened. They decided they did not have enough evidence to do any new prosecutions, but that murder case was reopened. But at the time, people blamed the killing on Emmett Till. They said he went into this store, he acted outside of bounds, he whistled at a white woman, and that is a really contested story. We don't know that to be true. But he brought it on himself. And at the trial, the sheriff said, well, you know, he was a really well-developed man, essentially, though he was a 14-year-old boy, with well-developed private parts, right, implying that he was a sexual threat who needed to be contained. And so some of the debates that we see today about what went on in particular crimes, they look clear-cut to us now, what happened in the 50s and 60s, but at the time they were contested as well. And I see that actually as a sign of the way race works today, in that all the what is going on in Ferguson and is it about race? Is it about something else? Part of what happens in our society today is it is very hard, I think, for us to see the way race continues to operate. And we've told ourselves as a society a lot of stories about, well, we passed laws and we have a black president and we know that racism doesn't look exactly the same as it did. And so we could say even with some, you know, publicly what happened in Ferguson isn't about race. I would say it's probably not only about race, but to claim that it's not about race in any fashion, as let's say Fox News has done, is just astonishing and is an astonishing willingness to ignore our history and our present.
Renee Romano, author of Racial Reckoning, professor of history at Oberlin College. Renee, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.